based on today's data that we have about human health, based on today's data that we have about planetary health, a plant, very plant-rich or plant-exclusive diet does make the most sense. It's really the only way forward for us to progress as a species to start to squeeze chronic disease out of our communities, but also to feed a growing population without further degrading our planet. Times are related is your currency.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Eat Green, Make Green podcast. This is Pat McCauley, as always. My guest this week is the legend, Simon Hill. For those that don't know, Simon is an Australian nutritionist and physiotherapist, or what we would call here in the U.S. a physical therapist. And over the past 5 years or so, I think especially for the younger generation, he's become this leading voice in the world of nutrition science. He just released his new book called The Proof is in the Plants, which is absolutely exceptional, as is everything Simon does. And I highly encourage you check it out, and I'll leave links to that and all he does in the notes. So we talk about how this huge ex-Australian football playing dude became obsessed with nutrition science. And why, when he first started diving into the science, and as he was going through his nutritional degree studies and everything, why what he found led him to adopting a plant-based diet. The new science around LDL cholesterol and ApoB, how sleep affects your blood glucose control, the science on the debated foods like chicken, fish, and eggs, why all plants have all essential amino acids, why there is no difference when it comes to muscle growth, whether you're putting plant-based protein in your body or animal-based protein in your body. We talk about his take on macros, why a plant-predominant diet is our best bet for long-term health, the new studies on the effects of exercise on our microbiome, which was super interesting, and how Simon goes about achieving the massive goals that he has. Incredible episode. I'm sure many of you are familiar with Simon and all he does, so no need to say more. He's an absolute legend and just a fantastic guy. Without further ado, the one and only Simon Hill. Times are related is your currency. All right, I got the Simon Hill with me. I feel like, man, there's like a lot of, I know we've had like a lot of overlapping guests over the past few years. I know you just had Matthew Kenny on, and you've had Alan Desmond and Paul Shapiro. I know we both recently had, and I know we've talked about doing this a couple times as you've floated in and out of the U.S., but it is an absolute pleasure to have you. I have followed you many years and enjoyed the very reasonable voice that you are in the nutrition world. And I just respect all you do. And official welcome to the show, man.
Oh, thank you very much. The feelings are certainly mutual. And you're right, this one has been a long time coming. I just said to you off air, I'm surprised we haven't crossed paths in person. Hopefully we get a chance. I'd love to get into the plant pub and spend some time with you in person. But for now, at least we're making it happen remotely.
Absolutely, man. Well, I know people that listen to this show, I'm sure most of them are already familiar with you. But for those that aren't, I would love to kind of go back and give just a little cliff note version of how this Australian football dude became obsessed with nutrition science.
Yeah, probably since I was a very young kid, I developed an appreciation for science. And I realized how science allows us to test our intuition and our hypotheses in a very objective manner, so that we can, you know, reduce uncertainty certainty and make more informed decisions that can improve our lives. Essentially, when you break it down, that's what we're aiming to do, improve our experience and hopefully the experience for everyone around us and the planet itself, all life. And that really entered my life through my father. My dad did his PhD in physiology, went on to become a professor. And so, of course, at home, there were piles and piles of scientific papers printed out, either he was reading others, his colleagues' work, or, you know, publishing his own papers. And he's gone on to publish hundreds and hundreds of papers in leading journals like Circulation and Cell, and had an enormous career in science. So I was, you know, surrounded by science from such a young age. I knew that eventually when I grew up, I would explore it in some way. And I kind of chopped and changed. At one stage, I thought I would become a doctor, an MD. And at another stage, I could see myself wearing a white lab coat like my dad and working, you know, under a microscope and looking at cells. And I often spent time on the weekends with him in his lab. So I saw a lot of that firsthand, him and his friends working in the lab. And when I finished high school, I didn't quite get the grades to do medicine. My grades were pretty good, but not close enough, or not high enough, I should say. And so I pursued physiotherapy, and I really wanted to get into sports physiotherapy, which I think in America, people call it physical therapy. It's slightly different terminology. And I was playing football, and so I was very familiar with the role of a sports physiotherapist within that sport. And that looked like a really interesting career and something that I could see myself enjoying. And it would enable me to stay in this football club environment that I found to be a lot of fun. You know, the not just the game day and the success on the field, but the camaraderie and the banter and just the lightheartedness sort of nature, kind of behind the scenes, what you don't necessarily see on match day. I really enjoyed that. I still do to this day. And so I did pursue that, and I went on and worked as a physiotherapist with professional footballers in Australia. And I really, really enjoyed that part of my career. And eventually I felt like I had I was missing something in terms of my overall understanding of health and wellness. And I was motivated to pursue more study, to go back and do a master's in nutrition science. And I became very obsessed in a healthy way with nutrition science and trying to make sense of what is a terribly confusing topic. You know, if I really feel for the average person who has a career not in nutrition, is busy and is trying to make sense of things, it's very difficult with the way the headlines change and you see one thing on social media and then you scroll and you see something that's conflicting. And so what I wanted to do and my goal was to develop the skills so I could actually get to the primary literature and look at the studies, look at the interventions, and try and make sense of things in a very objective manner. And with that, you know, eventually I decided to change my own diet and then, of course, pursue everything that I'm doing now.
I love it. I love it, man. And I would imagine, like myself, you were going into looking into nutrition science with this background. I would imagine that was very animal product focused, high protein focused. Mm-hmm. That is, at least as me being an American, ex-American football player, like that was our world. And that's how I went into nutrition science, asking questions about protein and you know, lean meats, and that was all like my thinking. But I would imagine you jumped in a similar fashion.
I did, and to be honest, when I was initially sort of inspired to go back and study nutrition science. My brother had sort of led me to this idea, this idea that perhaps the way that I was eating was not great for my long-term health. And, you know, I was not eating an ultra-processed diet. I was eating a diet that was very high in protein, animal protein, and had very little plant diversity, but I wasn't unhealthy. It was kind of allowing me to achieve my goals, and it was the normal way that everyone in Australia and in this football club fitness culture was eating. So I had no real reason to question it until my brother just put a little bit of information in front of me that encouraged me to dig deeper. And when I was going in and looking at the science, I actually really wanted to justify my current diet. I didn't want to change the way I was eating because it was working for me. And so it was very challenging to start reading the research and seeing that, well, maybe although I feel good today, maybe this is setting me up for failure long term. And it took me a while to sort of come to grips with that. And then, you know, once I had realized that, look, if I do value my long-term health here, this isn't a case of let's deal with cardiovascular disease in a couple decades and then it'll all be okay. We can change my diet then. I realized that diseases like that are bubbling away under the surface for decades. And so if I want to avoid having a heart attack in my 40s or 50s or 60s, I need to start making these changes now. And, you know, being the big meat eater I was, that was a very, very confronting and challenging thing to hear. You know, I kind of almost did everything I could to not come to terms with that. And it would have been easy for me just to look the other way and continue going down that path. But in the back of my mind, I would always recall this day where I saw my dad have a heart attack in front of me. And so for me, you know, and that was when I was 15 years old, I had seen acutely what loss of health looks like. And I still think, had I not experienced that, I'm not sure I would have ever changed my diet. I think I would have just kept going down the path that I was and ignored the data and said, well, you know what, I'm feeling pretty good. You know, the data is wrong. And so, I realized that if I did value my long-term health, I want to be healthier for longer. I need to start thinking about making some changes. And then of course you have, you know, all of the common questions that come up with regards to, you know, if I make these changes, am I sacrificing anything now with regards to my health, with regards to my performance, my athletic endeavors? And, you know, that took a little bit of time to sort of work through and build my confidence up. But, you know, over time and slowly making changes to my diet, I was able to see that, you know, yes, you can in fact lower your risk of these chronic diseases and still perform and achieve all of your goals now. It's not about giving that up.
Yeah. So there was a little bit, it wasn't like purely following the science. As you started to experiment, you also felt like your body was agreeing with what the science was telling you?
Yeah. You know, science at the end of the day, a lot of what we see is the average. It speaks to the average result. But you and I are not average. And so, you know, of course, we can take that data. We need to apply it in our own lives and see how we feel. And I think that positive sort of feedback cycle is really important. And I think most people experience this. And that's what encourages people to continue to make changes to their diet is once you get started, you know, just getting started at whatever extent it is, you do start to notice that you feel better, whether that's your energy levels, whether that's sleep, whether that's recovery. And then, you know, these were things that I was experiencing and it was encouraging for me. It was positive feedback that my body's responding really well to this and I'm not giving up anything. I'm actually gaining here. And, you know, on top of that, I realized that I can make this food taste delicious. So I'm also not giving up anything in terms of my joy for food. And so over a 6 to 9 month period, I transitioned from a diet that was very, very animal based and lacked plant diversity to a completely plant exclusive diet, and landed in that position. And then, you know, years down the track, the planetary health and the animal welfare side of things started to become more meaningful and more important to me, things that I became more aware of. And then, you know, that really, for me, those elements are what they're the strongest argument for a completely plant exclusive vegan diet. And that's kind of part of my thesis in the book.
Yeah. So is there any new science? I know you talk about, you're on podcasts, especially with the book, you're on podcasts all the time and you're talking about all kinds of stuff, but is there anything like over the past few months that is like new to you and compelling?
There's a few things. One thing that I actually think is not necessarily new, but not spoken about a lot is, you know, we talk about LDL cholesterol, and I think people are fairly aware that having high LDL cholesterol is not great in terms of your risk of cardiovascular disease. And we know that certain foods will increase LDL cholesterol, particularly foods rich in saturated fat, like animal foods, or most animal foods. And I think the general understanding is that cholesterol is what causes the fatty plaque buildup in the artery, what's called atherosclerosis. And I'm not sure if you've spoken about this on your show before. So I guess if I rewind to try and, let's see if I can do this, explain this in a way that makes sense, because it is terribly complicated. But cholesterol and triglycerides cannot, they're not water soluble, right? So they cannot just dissolve into our blood and move through our blood to cells. They have to be carried, and they're carried by proteins called lipoproteins. So you can imagine that a lipoprotein is a bit like a cargo ship. And the shipping containers on top are your triglycerides and your cholesterol, okay? And so there are different types of lipoproteins. So people will have heard of LDL, which is low-density lipoprotein. And then perhaps they've heard of HDL, which is often called the good cholesterol, high-density lipoprotein. There are others. There are VLDL and IDL. Okay. Now, why is LDL cholesterol considered bad and HDL cholesterol is considered good if both of those contain cholesterol? And the answer is, it's not cholesterol that makes them atherogenic. And by that, I mean, it's not cholesterol that causes them to get stuck in the artery wall. What it is on that shipping container, each of these lipoproteins have a particular protein. On LDL particles, VLDL and IDL, the protein is called ApoB. That protein, ApoB, is what causes those lipoproteins to enter the artery wall and get retained and stuck. And because they hold cholesterol, it builds up and you get this fatty plaque buildup. But it is the ApoB protein that causes it to get lodged. Whereas on HDL, there is no ApoB protein. It's an ApoA protein. So the reason I tell you this is because going forward from here, 5, 10, 15 years, I think what we'll see is LDL cholesterol as a marker when you go and get a blood test will begin to get phased out. And even though it is a reliable marker, ApoB is even more reliable because it accounts for all of the LDL cholesterol molecules, but also the VLDL and IDL, which are also atherogenic. So if someone's listening and thinking, you know, I'm going to get a blood test soon, it's worth requesting because in many places you can get ApoB tested for. So I guess that would be one thing that of late I haven't spoken much about on other shows, but I think there's a lot of research that's come out, particularly the last 5 years, that does speak to that being a better marker of cardiovascular disease risk. Something else that I saw that you may be interested in is a recent study. This was part of the PREDICT study, which is an ongoing study out of the United Kingdom. And this study looked at how does our sleep, both duration and quality, affect our blood glucose control. And it's really, really interesting because it speaks to our physiology and ability to use nutrients. The fact that that is affected not just by the foods we eat, but by our overall lifestyle. And what it showed was subjects who went to bed late or had disrupted sleep, so less effective sleep, these people ended up having worse blood glucose control at breakfast time. And so the takeaway from that paper was subjects who would go to bed early, who had a better sleep routine, they experienced better blood glucose control. And it's likely that this is tying into our circadian rhythms. And we know that our circadian rhythms do directly affect our metabolism and our ability to metabolize lipids and glucose. And most people have experienced a very acute disruption of our circadian rhythms. If you fly to the other side of the world, you experience jet lag, right? But you can actually put yourself into a state of chronic jet lag just by disrupting the circadian rhythms a little bit day in, day out. And so an example of how many of us do disrupt our circadian rhythms is, you know, it's late at night. Let's say it's 11 p.m. Now, traditionally at 11 p.m., our ancestors, they didn't have artificial light, so it was dark. We're sitting in a room at 11 p.m. with the lights on, and perhaps we're eating a meal, okay? These are two things that our ancestors would not have been doing, at least not regularly, many thousands of years ago. And what we're essentially doing is, you know, we might be sitting, for example, in Boston at 11 p.m. with the lights on, eating a meal, and we're telling our body we're in Sydney. And right. And why that's important is it starts to shift these circadian rhythms, these natural fluctuations in a whole lot of physiological pathways, you know, things like our body temperature, release of hormones like cortisol and melatonin. And so I guess in short, this study is a reminder of the importance of not just siloing off one component of our lifestyle, but really if we are wanting to achieve optimal health, we don't have to do everything perfectly, but we do want to be thinking about all of this from a holistic angle and looking not just at the foods that we're eating on a consistent basis, but the sleep and do we have a sleep routine? Are we trying to avoid late night light exposure? Are we trying not to eat too close to going to bed? Are we trying to keep a consistent routine with our sleep? All of these things are really good ways to nurture and nourish your circadian rhythms, which will directly affect your physiology and your risk of disease, how energetic you feel, how sharp your mind feels, etc.
Yeah. Yeah. On that note, do you have an opinion on kind of what percentage of kind of the overall wellness of a person, like what percentage you would kind of attribute that to diet and what, you know, what is everything else, the sleep, the exercise, the relationships? I know it's complicated, but how big of a piece of pie is it? Like, in terms of preventing disease and being healthy?
I think they're all terribly important. I think where we're going wrong the most is probably nutrition. And I think that there was a study called the Global Burden of Disease Study in 2018 that looked at a bunch of risk factors. Mind you, I don't believe sleep was in there, but alcohol consumption and smoking, all of this stuff was in there, and diet was by far the largest predictor for development of chronic disease and premature death. I think it would be hard to kind of quantify what's more important between diet and sleep and exercise. I think bottom line is, if you want to achieve optimal health, you need to spend some time looking at each of them. Mm-hmm. And one of them is not going to be a silver bullet.
Mm. Yeah. How do you, when people ask you about sort of the debated kind of in between foods, and what I mean by that, at least with conversations I have with kind of your average person, mm-hmm. I think most people are trying to cut back on red meat. Most people are trying to cut back on processed foods, and they understand kind of those two pieces of the puzzle. But there's often misunderstanding or debate around kind of the in between things, like the things I personally used to eat all the time, and probably you, like chicken and fish, mm-hmm. and kind of those things that still for many people are considered health foods. And I know your answer is probably going to be compared to what, yeah. But do you sort of answer that question, or how do you talk about those mm-hmm. foods when somebody asks your opinion on them?
I do normally start with compared to what, so you've clearly done your homework. And I mean, it's worth not glossing over that. It's really important, because anytime we want to evaluate is a food healthy or not, we have to consider not only what that food, the nutrients it contains, and what that food matrix looks like, but what would it be displacing, or what would it be replaced by in someone's diet? So, I mean, I like to sort of categorize foods into three sections, three different columns. The first foods are foods that we know absolutely are associated with improved health span and lifespan. In the middle are like the inconsistent. It's a little wishy-washy. There's research on both sides. Someone that wants to advocate for them can pluck a study, and someone that wants to advocate against them could pluck a study. And then you have the ones that are consistently associated with poor health outcomes, pretty much no matter which way you look at them. And so if we start with the foods that are consistently associated with good health, it's all of the whole plants, fruits, vegetables, whole grains, legumes, nuts, seeds, herbs, and spices. That's that column. You can't fault those foods, and everyone should be eating more of them. And then you have the middle column is where you'll have lean meats, particularly poultry, fatty fish, not fried. You'll have eggs and low-fat dairy. And then you have on the far right, you have your fatty meats, your processed meats, your salted and fried fishes, full-fat dairy, etc. So I think that middle column is what you're talking to, which is the low-fat dairy and eggs and fatty fish. Usually they come up. And a lot of this does come down to the study you're looking at. If you look at people that are consuming those foods instead of processed meats, ultra-processed foods, they usually do better. And that's not something that you could really debate. But then if you look at, there are a couple of very big studies that come to mind. These are large observational studies. There's one by Song et al. And another one by Budatoki. I can provide these references for you. But they're looking at what happens when you substitute calories from animal protein from these foods, from fish, from eggs, from low-fat dairy, for calories from plant protein. And that's a really important question. What happens if you swap some of the calories from those foods for legumes, for example, or nuts? And what we see is either a neutral effect or a beneficial effect, depending on the paper that you look at. So my overall position is that I think there is probably some room for some of those foods within a very, very plant predominant, plant rich diet, but it's not a lot. It's much less than most people would assume. And really, I think the strongest case for minimizing them as much as possible or eliminating them is when you consider planetary health. For example, the overfishing problem that we have and the damage that that's having on our ocean ecosystems. When you consider dairy, which has one of the largest environmental footprints of animal foods, but behind beef. And then, of course, when you consider animal welfare, I think that creates the most compelling case to move to a diet that is as plant exclusive or vegan as possible for that person.
Mm. Yeah. Do you think, I know you mentioned like ancestors a little bit earlier. Do you think we're built to eat only plants, or do you think we're like, that's just our best option in 2021 for all the different factors that you're just talking about now?
I think you could not argue, you couldn't create an argument that our ancestors ate a plant only diet. That's not the case. But also equally, we have to remember that Homo erectus had very different goals to what we have today. Mm. You know, Homo erectus was eating to survive. And the goal of evolution is to pass on your seed, to procreate, right? And I would argue that most people today and people listening to this are also very motivated by living as long as possible and staying as healthy as possible. And so what made sense for Homo erectus may not make sense for us today, particularly when you also start to factor in the population size and sustainability. So, to sort of answer your question more directly, I think that based on today's data that we have about human health, based on today's data that we have about planetary health, very plant rich or plant exclusive diet does make the most sense. It's really the only way forward for us to progress as a species to start to squeeze chronic disease out of our communities, but also to feed a growing population without further degrading our planet. And, you know, it's a very unintelligent thing to continually damage your host. And we really rely on planet Earth, and so we better start looking after it.
Yeah. So you would agree with the fact that we as humans don't need animal products in our diet?
Oh, certainly. There's more than enough information to show that with an appropriately planned plant exclusive diet, you can absolutely thrive. And sure, you need to think about a few things, but I would argue that no matter how you eat, whether it's an omnivorous diet or a pescatarian diet or a plant exclusive diet, we need some level of planning. If people are just sort of shooting in the dark, I mean, have a look how the current omnivorous diet is serving us. It's not leading to the best of results. So yes, you can absolutely thrive on a diet without animal products. You need to be aware of a few things, but you can kind of set things up and then it's set and forget. And you just, you know, as you know, you just get on with your life.
Mm. Yeah. So on that front, I've heard you and seen you say this many times that all plants have all essential amino acids. And I know you probably talk about this until you're blue in the face, but I feel like it is important that we at least touch on that because it still is the most common question everybody asks.
Yeah. We have about 30,000 proteins more that are synthesized in our body to make various tissues, like collagen, for example, is a common protein that people are aware of. And these proteins are made up of amino acids. And amino acids, you can think of them essentially, they're the building blocks If you think about your bike chain, you know, each of those little kinks is an amino acid that makes up that entire chain being a protein. There are 11 non-essential amino acids. These are those little building blocks that your body can just make by itself. And then there are 9 essential amino acids. Your body needs you to consume these in your diet, and then they'll be absorbed and your body will use those along with the non-essential amino acids to create whatever proteins it really requires at that point in time. So really, this question zooms in and focuses on the 9 essential amino acids. And the heart of the question is, can you get these 9 essential amino acids from plants, or do you have to go and source your protein from animal foods? And the answer is no, you do not need to eat animal foods. All of those 9 essential amino acids are actually found in every single plant. The only way that someone would run into trouble here is if, for example, they ate one type of plant, brown rice, for example, for all of their calories. Okay. But as long as you're eating with just modest diversity, and you don't need to be doing protein combinations in particular meals, your body has a pool of these amino acids over a 24, 36 hour period. So as long as you're just eating with diversity throughout the day, you will be supplying your body with all of those 9 essential amino acids in the required amounts. One thing I like to also add here is that the food we contain, let's say chicken or black beans or tofu, they contain protein. And when we eat those foods, the protein gets broken down into amino acids in our stomach before we absorb them. And once those amino acids are absorbed, let's say leucine, for example, which is one of these essential amino acids, it gets absorbed and it goes into your bloodstream. At that point in time, that is just an amino acid. Your body has no idea as to whether that came from chicken or pork or bacon or tofu or black beans. It's not tagged with its source. It is literally just an amino acid compound, and your body utilizes it in the exact same fashion, no matter if it came from an animal or from a plant. And I think that's an important reminder for all of us.
I love it, man. You're putting on a, per usual, you're putting on a master class here, and I'm just soaking it all in. I love it. So on that front, would you say scientifically that we know now that when it comes to building muscle mass and lean muscle mass, that there is no advantage to having animal products in your diet?
Yeah, all things are equal if you're consuming the same amount of total protein. If we're talking about athletes here for a moment, the research is fairly consistent. And again, I want to caveat this because often I talk about this protein intake and people say, well, I consume less than that and I still have been able to build muscle. You can build muscle at lower than this figure that I'm about to say, but this is considered the kind of optimal intake for maximum gains, which seems to hover around 1.6 grams per kilogram of body weight. Maybe you can translate that into pounds at some stage. But there has been a study out recently that looked at healthy adults doing resistance training, and they had two different groups in this study. One of the groups was eating an omnivorous diet with a whey protein shake, and the other was eating a completely vegan diet with a plant-based shake. And this is the first study that's ever looked at a group of omnivores versus a group eating a completely vegan diet. There have been other studies that look at two different groups and one adds a plant-based shake, but they're doing it on top of an omnivorous diet. So this was a really, really interesting study to look at. And they match both these groups at 1.6 grams per kilo. one group's getting all animal protein, or not, or a mix, I should say, because it's omnivorous, and the other group is getting all plant protein. And they put them through this 12-week program, resistance training. They're measuring how much lean muscle do they build, and also what happens to their strength. And they found both groups had significant increases in lean muscle and in their strength, as you would expect. That's what happens if you have a high protein intake combined with resistance training. But there was no significant differences between groups. And that has started to change the way some of these, or many, I should say, the researchers in this space are now thinking about protein, because the more old school thinking was that animal protein is much more anabolic. But when we're measuring these health outcomes, which is what we care about most, we are not seeing a difference. Now, I would add to that that we need more science. I'd love them to run the same study in experienced weightlifters. These were healthy adults who were active, but were not sort of weekly gym goers. So I'd love that study to be replicated in people who have been resistance training for a long time, and also to be replicated, which I believe it will be, in elderly. We know that as people get to sort of 50 plus, 60, 70, it's a very important time to actually slightly increase your protein intake to maintain lean muscle, to avoid what's called sarcopenia, to slow down the rate of bone mineral density loss, which naturally occurs as we age. And because we know that as you get older, you develop what's called anabolic resistance, which basically means that for the same amount of resistance training, and perhaps for the same amount of protein intake, you are less able to grow muscle. And so it'll be an interesting study to see if in that population there's a difference. But so far, very promising signs. This is, of course, emerging science, which is now starting to support, of course, the many anecdotes that have been out there for many, many years of plant-based athletes who, you know, essentially have been speaking about their story and all of their success. Now we're getting some data to really support that.
I love it. How do you talk generally about macros? I often say on this show, at least for me in my experience, like the macro words were the most misleading words, like in my personal health journey. And I think they're the most misleading words we use in human health and nutrition in general. You know, the only reason I ate animal products in the first place, because I associated it with protein, right? And the only reason I avoided, you know, certain fruits and things like that, which are now like staples of my diet, was because of the word sugar and the word carbs. And how do you kind of talk about macros? And do you think we kind of get too much in the weeds with not only the macros, but, you know, blueberries are good for me because they have antioxidants, like, right? We kind of get obsessed with the nitty gritty instead of just say, hey, blueberries, we're not entirely sure why, but they promote human health, right? And an apple promotes human health. How do you think about that and make it relatable instead of focusing on the kind of misleading nitty gritty of it all?
Yeah, well, I think the macronutrients, I mean, they have their place, but they certainly serve to be a great distraction, and they cause a great deal of confusion, and they make us overlook the importance of dietary quality, the quality of the foods we're eating, which is so much more important than just ticking the boxes with macronutrients. And I think I know where this has come from. If you go back to the early 1900s, the diseases of the time, scurvy, beriberi, rickets, these were nutrient deficiency diseases. So it made sense. Let's zoom right in and let's think about vitamin D and vitamin C, because treating those diseases, that's what was required. But I think nutrition science has evolved a lot in this last 100 years. And so we've started to go away from this very reductionist thinking of just single isolated nutrients, single macronutrients. And now it's very clear that the best way for research to move forward is thinking about dietary patterns and food groups. And so, you know, we can, it's sometimes interesting to kind of dive into particular foods and to get into the nitty gritty, but I think it's more instructive for the ordinary person who just wants a real brief summary to think about the food groups. And I've sort of spoken earlier when I talked about those three columns, you can't go wrong if most or all of your calories are coming from fruits, vegetables, whole grains, legumes, nuts, seeds, herbs, and spices. And, you know, we could just keep saying that. But really you're right. Like if we just talk about protein, fat, and carbohydrates, we also run the risk of forgetting that these terms are umbrella terms. You know, carbohydrate spans from the jelly bean all the way to the black bean. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so not all carbohydrates are created equal. It's silly to have this idea out there that carbs are bad when carbohydrate as a term stands for such a diverse range of foods that have diverse effects on our physiology. And the same can be said with fats. We know that fats is an umbrella term. There are lots of fats that have deleterious effects on our physiology. And then there are fats like the monounsaturated and unsaturated fats found in avocado, nuts, and seeds, which really move our health in the right direction. And again, plant protein, we know that studies comparing animal protein with plant protein, looking at health outcomes, show significant benefits when you are dialing down on animal protein, adding more plant protein, reducing your risk of cardiovascular disease and type 2 diabetes. And part of that is probably the amino acid makeup of plant protein. And these plant proteins are slightly lower in certain amino acids that dial up some of the aging pathways like mTOR and raise IGF-1. Those mechanisms are still being teased out, but you'll hear longevity researchers like Volta Longo and David Sinclair talking about the benefits of, hey, you know, let's limit our exposure to some of those amino acids that are really concentrated in animal foods if we want to slow down some of these aging pathways. And then, of course, you know, sitting next to plant protein, you have fiber and phytonutrients. So there are other reasons for why making that swap offers benefits. But I completely agree with you. You can start to go into the weeds if you just focus on macronutrients. And I can set up, you know, on Chronometer, and I could set up two completely diets that have completely different effects on human physiology, but are the same macronutrient profile. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's just a reminder for all of us, think about the quality of the food you're eating. That is the single most important thing. And then look, if you have particular goals and you're an athlete and you want to track your protein intake or your total calorie intake, go for it. But I would be considering the quality of your overall diet first.
Totally. So well said. Yeah, it's like even when you say the word plant protein, right, in my head, I'm going, okay, well, you know, black beans do, although that's what you mean by plant protein, right? It's like black beans have a different effect on my body and my health than peanuts do, right? Mm-hmm. Even though they're both thrown in that same umbrella of plant protein, you know? So I'm just always like, I say this all the time. I'm just like, look at the food as a whole. Does it promote your health? That's the question, you know?
Yeah, we're definitely on the same page there. That's for sure.
So is there anything else? You know, I know we're talking about all the kinds of things that are in the book, but is there anything else on the nutrition front or anything in the book that you want to go into a little more depth on that we haven't really touched on?
Some of the nutrients of focus are interesting, but you may have covered those on the show previously. You asked me about new studies before, and I know you're into endurance exercise, and probably there are a number of listeners that are into endurance exercise and resistance training for that matter. And there was another interesting study that came out very recently. This was Dr. Will Bolsiewicz was part of this paper. Of course, well known for his book, Fiber Fueled. And this study was looking at a group of people with osteoarthritis. and they wanted to see, there's been a lot of research showing that with exercise, you increase the production of these molecules called endocannabinoids. And endocannabinoids are sort of like cannabis-like molecules, but they're produced naturally by our body. And they are thought to be responsible for that kind of runner's high, that feeling of euphoria. And very interestingly, there has been a lot of sort of mechanistic studies that have tied these endocannabinoids to our gut health. Mm-hmm. And this study showed that these endocannabinoids seem to act directly on our microbiome, and it increased the number of bacteria that produce butyrate, which is a very healthful compound that helps keep our maintain the integrity of our gut lining and decrease inflammation. And these endocannabinoids also seem to increase microbiome diversity. And we know that a diverse microbiome is associated with lower risk of allergies, autoimmune conditions, and various chronic diseases. So just an interesting study that's sort of, you know, starting to tie together things that we really didn't understand. And I guess I point this study out and I think it's a good example of the fact that science is forever changing. We're constantly learning. A lot of the insights we have into gut health and how beneficial plants are for the microbiome have really come off the back of technological advancements in the last 5 to 10 years. And before that, we actually didn't have the technology to look at the microbiome and understand what it was and what the compounds are that are produced by the bacteria. So, you know, it's more of a kind of watch this space. I suspect that over the next 5, 10, 15 years, we're only going to see more and more studies coming out that are explaining why we see populations who are eating plant predominant, very plant rich diets, having better health for longer.
I love it. So to change gears a little bit, to kind of wrap up towards the end here, a lot of people that listen here are entrepreneurs. Mm-hmm. You are a guy, I feel like every time I message you, you've been like in New York, you've been in LA, you've been in some mm-hmm. part of Australia or some other part of the world, London, I think, at some point. As an entrepreneur and somebody that is, you know, writing books and podcasting and has become this like really big voice in the nutrition world, do you have any techniques or tactics or ways of going about accomplishing goals that you set? Mm-hmm.
A lot. so it depends how deep we want to go here. You know, I mean, firstly, understand your vision and what your mission is and work backwards from there. I would say that's particularly important. And secondly, you know, procrastination can kill a really good idea. And I get asked all the time from people about starting a podcast or starting something. And one of my biggest pieces of advice is just get started. It's not going to feel perfect. I remember when I started my podcast, and it's far from perfect today, and it will never be perfect, but it was much less perfect, if that makes sense, back when I started, to the point where I would just not want to listen to any of those early episodes. And look, that's part of the growth and the journey. And it, you want to be looking back and cringing at your work from early on. So don't sit around and wait and think that day one, you're going to start with some masterpiece, because that's just not realistic. And that's not how anyone who has achieved anything in life did it. You know, everyone starts off, you know, with a lot less, skills and a lot less polish on what they're doing, and it'll be bumpy. And you know, just like if you set up your sat nav in your car to go to a destination, right? If you take a couple of wrong turns, it's fine. That sat nav will then redirect you to where you wanted to go. And so, on top of what I said earlier, I would add that achieving something, growing something, your business, it's not going to be linear progression. It's not. It's a non-linear process. So you are going to have those wrong turns. As Matthew McConaughey says, those red lights. And he's exactly right. That's part of it. It's going to feel frustration. But each time you feel that frustration, you just need to accept that that is part of you getting from A to B. And there will be a learning in that. So, I mean, that's probably my high level advice that I would offer, as well as where possible, trying to find a place where you can work on the business and not just in it the whole time. So if there are tasks that you feel could be easily outsourced to people around you in a way that's feasible based on your budget, then I would suggest doing that so that you can free up a bit of your time. And again, coming back to your vision and mission, work on some of the bigger picture ideas. And I think that's, one potential place where people get a little lost is when they get completely bogged down and they're trying to do too much. But again, that's part of it. You probably will reach that point and then you need to work out a way to breathe again and work on the business.
Mm. And other than the whole food plant-based diet, what are you doing on a daily basis to keep yourself fit and mentally fit and well and high performing and all that stuff?
Sleep is the number one, more and more important. And so I run different time zones, but I try as best as possible to stick to a fairly consistent routine where I'm in bed asleep before 10 PM. I will dial the lights down. I can't lie. I definitely don't turn all the lights off at 6 PM and recreate a kind of cave like setting, but I dial them right down, dim them right down. I try to avoid the bright, bright lights of my screen a couple of hours before going to bed. And I keep my room quite cool. I find I get a much deeper sleep with a cooler temperature. And then usually we'll get around 8 hours sleep most nights. In the mornings, it's one of the things I do try and do is at least in that first hour, get outside, expose myself to some bright light. And I'll work out in the morning. I usually, at least at the moment, I've been working out very early. So before I'd have breakfast, I get that done. I find if I procrastinate and leave it to later in the day, often it's something that I just don't end up doing. So I like to train for about an hour. I do resistance training probably 3-4 days a week. And then on the other days, I do more of an aerobic, higher intensity, get the heart rate up, training the cardiovascular system a little bit more. So sleep, training, and then realizing that, everything I'm working on is great, but so is having fun. And so, you have to, life can become very serious very quickly. I do have the kind of mentality where I can get bogged down in work and what I'm doing and long patches can go past where I haven't been catching up with friends or doing as much socially. And it definitely, I find it does affect me mentally. So prioritizing time, and it doesn't have to be heaps of time, but it needs to be good quality time where you can connect with people, whether it is your partner or your friends, over time where you are actually present. I find that is a beautiful way to stay grounded and to stay connected, and it creates a lot more meaning in my life, that's for sure. And that includes spending time with my parents who live in different states, which can be tricky, but also something that's very important. So, I mean, those are probably the main things. And then, on top of that, I will meditate. I'm not a really routine meditator, not at the moment. That's a habit that I'm actually trying to get more consistent with. Mm. And so currently my meditation practice dropped off. And so I'm starting again and just showing up and trying to do something every single day And then the idea will be to expand on that. But, you know, building new habits is tough. So starting small.
I love it, man. Well, I won't keep you much longer here, but I just want to thank you for all you do, because you, the way you speak about nutrition and just the way you carry yourself as an example, especially I think for men, is absolutely awesome. So just shout out to you, all the work you do, and please do leave us with where people can buy the book, best place to get the book, and where they can follow you.
Sure. Well, thank you for that. As I said, big honor to come on the show and spend time with you and time with the listeners. So very grateful for that. And I do hope we can cross paths and catch up. We'll get into
it. We will, man. Yeah, we will. We will.
We'll make it happen. And yeah, the book is published by Penguin. It's on shelves throughout the States. You can find it on Amazon or Barnes and Noble, all the various places. And you can find me at plant_proof.
Thank you, man.
Awesome. Thanks a lot, Pat.